Hi everyone, it's Six. I'm here doing the edit, and about halfway through this episode, my track gets very weird. The left-right balance gets kind of screwed up, and there starts to be some static in the line, and I've done what I can to fix it, so I think it's probably not, like, grating to the ears at this point, but it is not great. So audio quality gets a little bit crappy about halfway through. And I did what I could to fix it, so it should be listenable, but it's not fantastic. I'm sorry about that. Shouldn't happen again. Just a weird quirk with the setup, I guess. Well, thanks so much. I'll enjoy the episode. I'll kick it to past me.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Neutral Game, your newbie-friendly fighting game podcast. I'm Six Detmar of Scanline Media.
And I'm Miro Kovacevic of Real Soviet Bear Enterprises.
What do you enterprise?
Bears.
Okay, alright. Just checking. You know, I've never asked before, and it felt rude of me to just let that go every time without ever inquiring as to your interests and passions. We're here this month because EVO has just ended. EVO 2018 has come and gone. Well, I say just, but obviously by the time this episode comes out, it'll have been a little while. And every time EVO comes up, it's a good time to look at what fighting games look like as a spectator experience, as an audience, you know? Like, we spend a lot of time talking about getting good at playing fighting games, and feeling comfortable, and learning what works for you. But we don't spend very much time talking about the other side of it, which is there are plenty of people who just like watching fighting games, and even if you weren't purely a spectator, there are some games where you probably are. I'm never going to be a hardcore Dragon Ball FighterZ player, but I will always enjoy watching it. And the things that make a game a good spectator experience are not always the same things that make it a good playing experience.
Being able to spectate a game with enough readability and understanding is something a lot of games struggle with. Generally, if it's something super big like League of Legends or Dota, you kind of rely on people who are watching, having played it at some point, and understanding what's happening, even if they're not fully active in it. But with other games, where it's kind of hard to understand everything, or where you don't have the big player base consisting, the player base being primarily also your viewer base, like Overwatch, there's a lot of struggle understanding how to make spectator tools, or how to make it more spectator friendly. Like, I mentioned Overwatch because they have a big tournament and a big league going, and they invested a lot of updates into actually improving the spectator experience.
Mm-hmm. And yet I still don't think it's very good.
It's very hard to keep track of things, yes.
That's partially just an FPS problem. It's a genre that has a lot of trouble with it. But fighting games can be a really good fighting game, or spectating experience. Or they can be kind of bad, and it kind of comes down to a lot of different elements. I think a lot of them, like, first and foremost, you have to talk about the elements of the game's design, right? You talk about, like, especially presentation of the game, like the way the game is presented and its graphics, sound design, and its UI. It's the first thing that people notice, and it is the first step towards people, like, clicking with the game or not.
Yeah, you think that fighting games would just naturally transition into a very easy-to-follow viewer sport, but because you mostly, you know, have boxing, you have MMA, you have real-life fighting tournaments, which people are able to follow. But in a lot of cases, what you know about, like, say, fighting boxing, like, boxing goes on until, you know, the bell rings or until one person is no longer standing. So you have, like, very simple things to follow, and you can see, oh, was that hit hard or was it not hard? Whereas, because you're abstracting stuff in fighting games, you don't necessarily know whether a move was a good move, whether doing a longer combo is a good thing or a bad thing, because it varies from game to game, and you just have a lot of things that aren't as intuitive.
Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of that comes down to readability, right? Like, I've talked to people who, I have one friend in particular who, like, as a playing experience, actively loathes fighting games. They hate fighting games. But they really enjoy watching Evo, and specifically Street Fighter V, because it's a really good spectator experience. And Street Fighter, especially, manages to boil things down in such a way, like, say what you will about Street Fighter, and I have on this podcast. But Street Fighter V and almost every iteration of Street Fighter is like a really clear, like, one-on-one context. It's really easy to tell, like, okay, here's footsies, sort of like people dancing back and forth outside of each other's range. Especially with Street Fighter V, they added crush counters, which is like a really good bit of animation and sound design to make it be like, oh, that was a big hit. And like everything about Street Fighter's design makes it really easy to tell, like, who's winning and how much something matters.
Yeah, because the only real quote-unquote extra elements that Street Fighter has are the Super Meter and the V Meter. And if you can kind of understand that the Super Meter is your credit for a big attack, which I think a lot of people can understand, you can for most part ignore the V Meter, because that one manifests more on the character. Like if somebody activates their V skill, you see their character flashing, or you see them doing more powerful moves, but you don't necessarily need to understand how long that lasts, how powerful that is. You just know, oh, okay, he's doing something special right now. So like from a viewer perspective, it's not as important, and you can kind of live without it. I guess some stuff that might be lost is if you do a super and you miss it, like how damaging that actually is, unless you're really into the game. But in general, Street Fighter does a good job of distilling it to very few elements. And from what I haven't played Street Fighter V in a while, but I watched, in preparation for this, I watched the Grand Finals again. And I noticed how very exaggerated the moves are in a very good way, because it's very clear what hits when, why it hit, or how somebody avoided the hit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's very easy to follow in that way. So there's that element. I think one of the other things that makes a good, like, there's sort of another approach, and you can combine these two, but often there's not a lot of overlap between that and the spectacle way of approaching people, which is the same reason, like, spectacle is the reason that Marvel vs. Capcom was popular every year and went to Evo. It wasn't very readable. It was really hard as an outsider to tell what was happening in a match. But it was just so flashy and ridiculous that it was kind of hard to look away. And so there's an element of that as well, of just like how exciting, like, you know, a good super animation looking really cool, and just sort of like the, you know, the flash and boom of an average match can be really enticing to a standard viewer.
Tekken 7 makes good use of that, because when I was playing, I didn't notice it much, but when watching the game, if you're paying attention, you can actually see how well they use camera angles. Like, those sharp camera changes for a moment, like if you hit somebody against a wall, or if you do a specific attack, or when you do a super, or even the, you know, slow-mo close finish thing. And it's not a particularly flashy game. The effects on the hits are very low-key compared to, you know, other contemporary fighting games, but those camera angles really make it more exciting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they really sell the action, and they help spectators sort of buy into the action, because, you know, with the camera work, they're really showing you what matters, what's important, and helping you feel the tension and hype of a match in a way that's really effective. I think Dragon Ball FighterZ and Guilty Gear also do this with their use of camera angles sometimes. Guilty Gear doesn't do it as much as Dragon Ball does, where it's like if you get a dragon rush off, which is their throw, like the camera zooms in as you do like the flurry of punches, and then swings behind the character who runs back as they uppercut them into the sky, and it's like it's very dynamic in that way. And that's to go along with just the standard spectacle of Dragon Ball FighterZ, where there are giant beams and shit everywhere, which of course is exciting and just fun to watch.
It's interesting to compare the two, because how Dragon Ball uses camera angles is more often in anticipation So when, like you said, when you do a super move or when you do a teleport or things like that, but most of them are basically, oh, here's like a big move happening, and then if that move misses or is blocked, it's like a bit of a downer. Like, it has stuff that's a camera angle if you do hit somebody. But Tekken is kind of the opposite, where most of the camera angle shifts are when something has already happened. Like, when you hit somebody against a wall, when you hit them with a specific move and they fly to the side. And it only really has the super move as the big anticipation.
That's a good point. So with Dragon Ball, it's kind of like, you know, like a hold your breath moment. This could go, you know, this is tense, this could go either way.
Yeah.
And with Tekken, the camera angle shift is the payoff.
Yeah, it's the payoff, so it, like, it sells the action more. And I think in Tekken, it's only the supers and the dramatic slowdown that aren't guaranteed to be a thing. And it only really suffers with the super, because in general, if you see a tournament and somebody does a super, in 80% of the cases, the commentators already know, oh, that's going to be blocked or that's going to miss. Like, it's very rare that you have, like, oh, is that going to hit?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the other factor, I think, that especially hurts a lot of games that I love a lot is the concept of insider mechanics, which is, you know, there's probably a better phrase for this. That's just the one that I came up with. But it's like having systems and features in the game that if you're just watching, you will never figure out on your own, basically. You will only figure out if someone explains them to you or if you play the game. And the best example of this is almost every character-specific feature in BlazBlue.
It's not even just character-specific feature. It's just by default, the global meters are very ridiculous. Whenever I explain, let's just explain like regular BlazBlue, for example, you have the overdrive meter, whose duration depends on how little health you have, which can also be used as a burst, which also freezes the timer. Then you have a super meter, and a super meter can be used for supers, guard breaks, or character-specific things. And then you have an additional special meter, which varies per character, and then you have the barrier meter, which is used for pushback and negating chip damage. So I'm running out of fingers on one hand, and I'm slowly going to the other hand, and that's not a good thing. Right. And then on top of that, one thing I've noticed that happens in Arc System Works games that doesn't happen as much in other fighting games is, oh, did that hit? Or, oh, will that hit? And because even though, like, Street Fighter uses invulnerability frames, games like BlazBlue or BlazBlue Cross Tag have so many weird invulnerability frames that sometimes when an interaction happens, you're not really sure what's going to happen. And then if something misses, even though it looked like it should have hit, you're just left confused. Like, why didn't that connect? Because they simply use invulnerability or move properties in a far different way.
And we've talked about this in the past, but this is one of the weird instances where it can get worse as a series goes on. Like, we've talked about, like, you know, Soul Bad Guy has moves in Guilty Gear where he looks like he's just doing a normal punch, but he has full invulnerability on the upper half of his torso. And so he'll just be standing there sticking his arm out, and the entire top of half of his body, if you try and hit it, you'll just fly right through him. And that's because of a history of an entire series' worth of balance changes and shifts to his game design. But the result is it just looks weird as hell to a spectator.
Yeah, it's very weird, and it's very weird to explain, like, why are you invulnerable? I think for a lot of people it's a given, like, oh yeah, it's an anti-air move, of course it's upper body invulnerable, but when you just tune in and want to watch a game, it's very abstract as a concept of why are they immune in the upper body. I feel like if Street Fighter ever I'm sure Street Fighter has a few weird interactions, but in general, in Street Fighter, at least from what I've seen, it seems much clearer if something isn't gonna hit or is gonna hit.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's much more obvious from the jump, and that, yeah, it makes it harder for people to watch this stuff. Because, yeah, I mean, like, even as you say, setting aside character-specific stuff, they're just weird interactions and just so many system-level mechanics that often Arxis games especially are just harder to watch.
Yeah.
I think this is also the case on, like, we mentioned Marvel earlier. One of, like, the big things that people will do in Marvel versus Capcom, let's take 3 as an example. You can do this in any Marvel versus Capcom game, is you can, like, super jump to the top of the screen and then call an assist. And, like, there's a little arrow indicating that your assist is out there, but, like, even to people who are playing the game, they have trouble understanding what's happening there. If you're an outsider, it's just like, okay, they jumped to the top of the screen and they came down and their opponent was, you know, like, being electrocuted, and I have no idea why.
Yeah, yeah. It definitely makes the game more satisfying to play, but it does take away a lot of the viewer engagement. Like, you're not really sure why things are happening. I mean, even I sometimes, like I'm playing BlazBlue Tag daily, and even sometimes then, like, some weird interactions happen, and I just stare at the screen and don't understand why didn't somebody not take damage, or why did I get away with something I shouldn't have? Like, it makes no sense.
Yeah, especially because that game has invincibility and, like, weird cancels, and it has a lot of strange properties to try and make the game more dynamic and fast-paced, but it does sometimes lead to some really bizarre moments.
I mean, it makes it work from a balancing perspective, because the more knobs you have that you can turn, the tighter you can make something handle. The problem is, when you're turning those knobs, you're not in a position to update the actual visuals of the game. So, we already mentioned this, you always have that disconnect, and that's just how Arc System makes their games.
Speaking of which, a lot of those knobs get turned because of attempts to balance the game. And one of the big things that can put people off is balance. And not in the most direct sense, but it's you know, just a natural result of balance, which is, like, if you're watching a top 8 and you see that everyone's playing the same character, you're going to get bored, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's a very weird line to thread, because ideally what you want in a game is there are weaker characters and there are stronger characters, and then those stronger characters are strong enough that people might pick them, but the weaker characters aren't too weak, so when somebody picks them, they have the advantage of, oh, nobody has played against this character that much, and now they're in competent hands, therefore even the stronger character is struggling because they aren't sure what to do. That's kind of like the ideal scenario, because you're never going to achieve, like, perfect balance. The problem is,
right,
when somebody is ridiculously more powerful than the rest of the cast, and, you know, you're here in a tournament, at the end of the day, you're here to win. This is your, like, for a lot of people, this is their day job. Like, they have to win, and, you know, you're putting a lot of investment in, a lot of people are counting on you, it might be a sponsorship opportunity, and if you have a choice to pick a character that will give you an advantage, you will generally go for it. Even if it's boring, that it's very human and reasonable to expect that people will go for it.
And especially, like, I mean, so this is a combination of balance and presentation sort of going bad in a game that I think generally does pretty well. Dragon Ball FighterZ, I think, mostly had pretty good balance at this Evo, though there were some problem characters, and the presentation is generally stellar, right?
Yeah, from what I've seen, like, there's a subset of characters that is almost not used at all. But it wasn't more common to have, like, a team composition. It was more common, like, oh, they have this as their secondary or tertiary character. Like, you know, seeing a Vegeta or a Bardock, because they're a very good, like, assist or a very good character to have as your secondary, like, pays off. But I didn't really see that many mirror matches with the exact same teams. Like, there were cases, but I don't remember too many.
Well, that's actually, you actually touched on what I was getting at, which was Bardock was in a lot of people's teams because he was very strong. And someone actually did the math because of this is an example of how sick people got of seeing Bardock. Bardock has his level 3 super, which is called Revenger Assault, where he, like, punches you 3 times and shoots a big beam. And it's kind of a long, obnoxious animation, but it's pretty powerful. And someone added up all the time that like the total time of seeing that super on screen during Grand Finals, and it was equal to the length of Winners Finals in Blaze Blue Cross Tag Battle. Like, just all those supers back to back.
Oh god, yeah, yeah.
And that's like that's a sign that you have one, a presentation problem, to an extent. Like, that super takes too long, and two, that there's a bit of a balance problem because that character is so prevalent. So like, you know, there are, even in games that generally do well, there are some little standouts, and like that number, like Blaze Blue cross tag battle matches go really fast. That number is not necessarily that bad if you really look at it. The problem is more that someone was inspired to do that math because they were so exhausted.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Dragon Ball Z's balance, like I said, is like, you have a bunch of characters that are never used, and then you have a bunch of characters that are almost always used in a team, and then it's just like this middle segment of people pick stuff per preference or strategy or whatever. So it's not as bad as it can be, but if it was a 1v1 fighting game, it would probably be extremely bad.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Also, speaking of balance, I just want to advise all future game developers of fighting games. If you want to make a strong character, you should get Norio Okamoto to voice that character, because Cell, Bison, and Johnny, who are all voiced by him, performed extremely well on Evo.
It does seem to be statistically the thing that makes a character strong is Norio Okamoto, which makes sense. You could see his voice carrying you that extra distance.
Yes.
This is not the only time we'll talk about Norio Okamoto, in fact, in this podcast.
I mean,
had something planned.
I mean, we will talk about him on every episode if I can find an excuse. But anyway.
He's pretty great.
Yeah.
And the other thing, more than just character variety, is also variety of playstyles. Because, like, just because you have two Ryus doesn't mean they have to play the exact same way. So, like, if you don't have the character variety, you can at least have a variety of styles to play that character. If you have both, that's great, but that's often difficult to achieve.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of, I guess in the grand finals of Dragon Ball, we did have two Bardocks. But I guess in the grand finals, you could see how Goichi was a bit more structured with a bit more like fixed strategy, and how Sonic Fox was a bit more messy in terms of like playing it like wild and loose and reactionary. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's good if you can have that. I guess the problem is if you have a situation where a specific character is so prevalent, what will likely happen is it's not just that character being prevalent, it's specific strategies with that character being prevalent. Like it's very rare for a character to be strong and then having, you know, a bunch of options. It's more like he is strong because there isn't a very effective way to play him.
Yeah, that's very often. The other thing, though, is we can't, as a spectator experience is a lot dependent on the design of the game, but you can't put it all on the game itself. A lot of it also comes down to the community. And one of the biggest factors that I feel like gets neglected often is how important it is to have good commentary.
Yes, because a lot of the people who do commentary in the fighting games community are usually players of that game, just because you need to be informed about the game, but also because a lot of people advanced into that role from regular players. But it also means that depending on how mature a game or an individual scene is often reflected in the actual commentary. So regardless of what I think of, for example, Street Fighter commentating has been for a while much more professional and, like, let's say mainstream presentable than, I don't know, like Blaze Blue commentary, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's just like the Street Fighter commentary at Evo especially is consistently just like crisp, professional. It uses like it talks with, like, clearly the commentators are talking with knowledge. They're not dumbing themselves down, but they're also talking in a way where it's approachable. I mean, you know, it's hard to beat like Seth Killian as far as taking the advanced and making it seem understandable. That man is an incredible commentator. And so the result is that Street Fighter, like, you always, like, those finals especially, you always feel like you understand what's happening, even if you don't know the game. And it just feels like it's really good at buying you into the situation and help. And you're not just caught up in the emotion. You're actually starting to see, like, oh, I see. Like, they're explaining not the specific moves, but they're explaining what this character is trying to do, and I see it.
Yes, they have the advantage of Street Fighter being a smidge slower than some other fighting games, but they do a good job of explaining why something happened and finding a good moment to actually explain it. You know, they're not going to go and explain stuff while there's very high stakes action happening. They'll explain it either during a combo that they're sure is not going to kill or isn't going to get dropped, or between rounds, or, you know, during low intensity moments. They did a really good job of asserting when they should comment on what's happening and when they should comment on what had just happened.
And another way you can go about it, like a pretty different, you mentioned how Street Fighter has the advantage of being naturally more slow, so it's more possible to do that kind of digestible, understandable commentary. Dragon Ball FighterZ does not have that advantage. Dragon Ball FighterZ is very fast, and it's pretty hard to do commentary if you're just explaining what's happening and making the player base understand. And so, like, the best Dragon Ball commentators have understood that that's not their objective, really. They try and make it at least, they try and help you understand to an extent. But a big part of what good Dragon Ball FighterZ commentary is an evolution of that Marvel style, where you're just trying to be friendly and make everything really exciting and hype. Getting back to Norio Wakamoto, you got the most, like, crowd participation in Dragon Ball, because in Top 8, anytime there was a Cell doing an intro, the with that Norio Wakamoto, like, power-ups, like, battle cry, the commentators always got the crowd to roar along, and it was incredible.
Yes, it was always so charming and funny, and I loved it. It's I'm almost disappointed that the commentary in Dragon Ball isn't like an anime, because, you know, because of the subject matter and because of how the finals went out. But yeah, like, the game is so fast that you just kind of have to amplify how people are feeling, or basically try and participate with the crowd and feel the same way they do, because, like you said, it is so fast and there are so many things happening at any given moment, especially with the assists.
Mm-hmm. So the commentary really leans into, like, the emotion and energy of the fight more than the specifics, and I think it's really effective. But even at Evo, it's not all happy stories as far as commentary goes. Even at Evo, we get some examples of commentary falling short. And I'll start off with the less egregious example, in my opinion. The Guilty Gear commentary this is not the sort of thing that I would even think that much about if I didn't regularly watch Evo with people who don't play fighting games. If I was just, like, year after year watching by myself, I'd probably think the Guilty Gear commentary was fine. Because the people are fairly friendly and they understand the game and they're doing a decent job of describing what's happening. But if you take even a second in the same room with someone who doesn't play these games, it's like they're using so much jargon that most of their commentary is incoherent. Like, when, you know, like, there's this big dramatic moment happening on screen and the commentator's going, oh, here comes the 6P counter hit, your friend is like, what the fuck is he talking about?
Yeah. I'll be honest, because I was watching Solo, I sadly did not notice that for the reasons you said, because I understand the jargon, but it's also because I understand what's happening on screen, so I don't really pay attention to the commentary as much. But that is true. Like calling something 6P or things like that, anti-air seems like a much more friendlier term, even if that also is a technical term.
He's gonna YRC the grinder, Mio.
Yeah.
Just like, it's nonsense.
I sympathize with them because the problem with Guilty Gear is a lot of that terminology is tied to very crucial systems, like a failed YRC or Yellow Roman Council or a successful one can sometimes make or break a match.
Totally.
And it's just like because a lot of those matches come down to actually using those systems correctly, and in a lot of cases, again, if you're just a viewer and somebody wins because of a YRC, you'll just see somebody move from one move to another, and you won't really understand the significance of that play. So it's very problematic. Like, how do you convey to people that this very technical thing and very game specific thing was something that decided around?
It's funny because I think the best example I've ever, the most effective Guilty Gear commentary I think I've ever seen, is so situational. But basically, it was a Chip versus Slayer, and like the first like 3 seconds of the game, there was a clash that led into Danger Time, and one commentator just started saying Danger Time, Danger Time, Danger Time, while the other person in the background was just having a breakdown. And it was like, it was that Dragon Ball or Marvel, like, oh, I can totally understand, like, the emotion and craziness of the situation, because the odds of that are ridiculous, and the result of Chip getting one-touched from nothing is just bizarre and hilarious.
And then it's like you wonder, like, Danger Time happens, and then you have to explain to people, so why the Danger Time happens? Because they clash. Oh, is that always there? No, it's only sometimes. I guess because, again, Guilty Gear is very satisfying to play. It's just like, how do you explain the significance? But I guess the problem is you have MOBAs and you have MOBA commentary, and a lot of that also comes down to what gear you buy, or like very, like, crucial decisions that decide the entire match, but you have the space there. Like, these are like 30 to 40 minute matches, so you have time to explain, and there's a lot of downtime to explain these things in. But in the, like, in fighting games, it's very compact, so you have to wonder, like, how would you go about it? Like, I don't know. I don't know how, what the solution to this is.
I mean, I think the answer is to know when to, like to quit when you're ahead. Know when to be like, I think Guilty Gear is a game where generally the commentary should not be as worried about making things, like, making you understand everything that happened, and more about conveying the tone and flow of a match, because you're not going to get everything across.
Yeah, you know, you made a good point earlier when you said that they realized they couldn't do Street Fighter-style commentary with Dragon Ball, and so they found out the type of commentary they needed to do for Dragon Ball. And I think rather than having best practices of how to do commentary in general, aside from, you know, obvious things, it should be more like, how do you do commentary for this particular game? Because even though everything's a fighting right. game, it has a different pacing and different moments where you can put in different types of information. It almost feels like the way that the WWE has, you know, host/commentator guides of, like, what you should say and what you shouldn't say and when to say things. It almost feels like you should have this little Bible for each game in particular on Evo on how you should go about commentating and just some guidelines about it.
Totally, because I think, like, if you want to look at how bad things can go, I mean, you're going to get worse, but not at Evo. The Smash Melee commentary was terrible. And the biggest problem was that I don't know who that guy was on commentary, but it sounded like he was trying to prove how smart he was by throwing around as much jargon and insider info as possible. And, like, as a person who's watched Pro Smash for a while, most of the time I couldn't understand what the hell he was talking about. It seemed like he was trying to show off rather than provide information. And it was terrible.
Yeah, I sadly did not follow that, but I did follow some other Smash stuff, which we'll get into. But yeah, it's kind of like Evo is the spotlight, and you're not just, it's not just the players representing the game and themselves. It's also the commentators representing the game and the community. Like, everybody's kind of working together to have the game appear at its best on the show floor.
Right. Yeah, totally. And I think the other community element we should talk about is one that's a little, like, this is bigger scale, so obviously it's going to be harder to affect, but it is worth noting, like, the player base is going to be a part of what makes people get into the game or not. And that's, like, we're talking about diversity. We're talking about, like, one of the things that made me really hype, and I was bummed she didn't make it in the top 8, but, like, there was a major female pro in Dragon Ball FighterZ. Yohozi was kicking ass and taking names, and has been for a lot of the year. And it's like, hey, we don't get many women pros in fighting games. You get a lot of, like, especially in Street Fighter, you get a lot of people from different nationalities playing Street Fighter, where it's not just like, you know, US versus Japan, which it feels like in a lot of games is kind of the only narrative.
I was actually very glad with how Street Fighter went, especially with a UK player, Problem X, winning it, because, you know, when watching Guilty Gear, and then when watching Dragon Ball, I personally, as someone who is European, was very tired of the US versus Japan thing. It's always that, and it's always that every year, and I understand people get hyped for it, but it's also, EVO isn't marketed as the top US tournament anymore. They're marketing it as the top world tournament, but it still feels very much US-centric.
And, like, it's we still haven't gotten a moment to me that compares to, like, Punko, who was a South Korean player back in Street Fighter 4, when he became, like, when he started getting USA chants just because they liked how he played. And it was like, it's kind of dumb, because that's like, oh, this is the only chant the crowd knows. But it was the crowd, like, doing the, but in another way of looking at it was they were doing that same kind of passion they do for a hometown hero for this kid from South Korea who pulled off his shirt in the middle of the match.
Well, so
it was great.
So since I'm not as informed, was he playing against a Japanese player?
Yes, he was the only, I think he was one of two people left in top 8 who wasn't Japanese, and the other player wasn't American.
Yeah.
So it was like, it was kind of like adopting, and that's not great, but also, like, we don't even get that anymore. It is still just like either we have a U.S. player or everyone's like, oh, well, whatever.
Yeah. It's also because it's due to things we have not actually ever touched upon in this podcast, but also it is very hard to get into the U.S. Due to real-life reasons right now. So it is very hard, even harder than before, to actually, you know, it's usually expensive to get to the U.S., you know, going to the U.S. from, say, I don't know, like Sweden, it's a pretty big deal. But also with the addition of making it harder to actually get to the U.S., and, you know, Japan is pretty close to the U.S., it's going to be mostly U.S. versus Japan.
Yeah, part of the reason I haven't wanted to talk about it on the podcast is just because, like, I feel like anything I want to talk about, I would relate to the podcast and our topic, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't want to be, like opening up our borders more and allowing more, like, visas and visitors and stuff matters because I want better fighting game players. Like, that's a shitty angle.
It is.
We should do it because it's the right fucking human thing to do. And I don't think this is the place to get on that soapbox, but goddamn.
Yeah, yep. So often you will end up with the starter. But again, we had a UK player, a very good Bison player, win Street Fighter V against fan favorite Tokido. So that was very impressive.
And that's another thing, is getting back to that balance thing where we talk about seeing the same characters over and over. We've had a couple of years of Street Fighter V. I've never seen a Bison in top 8 before, and he won EVO.
Yeah. Yeah, it was really weird when I was told, oh yeah, Bison won Street Fighter, and I don't know much about Street Fighter V in terms of the meta right now, but I was confused because I don't recall when I heard Bison winning.
You were like, I forgot he was in there.
Yeah, like, I thought he was not that good.
Yeah. No, his dash through is pretty good, but the rest of him never seemed that good to me. But man, Problem X certainly made him look fucking impressive.
Well, yeah, it's also, again, what I said earlier, when people don't expect a character or when a character isn't played, then people like the matchup experience, and then when somebody gets good with him, it gets very scary.
Totally. So you know the Guilty Gear meta more than I do. Is Elfelt like a niche pick in Guilty Gear?
So Elfelt was really strong in the sign, because I believe she was not in the arcade version. She was added later in the in the console version. Same as Sin, so there was she wasn't the immediate pick of Japan, but she was in the West, and then people got in general pretty good with her, and she is really strong. I think she's not as strong as she was on release of Sign, but she's still pretty competent. Especially with those shotgun loops.
Strong enough to get third place at Evo when we got a American player, Lost Soul, taking third in a game that has been just dominated by Japanese players forever?
Forever. It's pretty much forever. It is... First off, I think this was Lost Soul's first Evo tournament. I'm not 100% certain, but I know he was considered a newcomer, and a new name. So he did a really good job, and it is very healthy from my point of view that there's more Western players breaking into Guilty Gear, and getting results, because for the longest time, you had the local scene in the US, before you had Netplay, and then you had the arcades in Japan, and obviously the people in Japan had a stronger community, more practice, more incentive to play. So, and a lot of that knowledge from a decade ago still carries over to the current game. So it's very good to actually see, players, not just new players, but players with new characters getting results. And also not seeing Raven win.
Yeah, I mean, if I had my way, next year, the Street Fighter winner would be from Brazil or something. I want this to continue to expand out, and I want to more and more tear down this U.S. versus Japan narrative, because one, it's played out; two, it's fucking ethnocentric and sucks ass; and three, the more people get an opportunity to compete and show their style in these games, the better off we are. Remember when in Marvel 3, there was this, established meta of how the game was played, and then from South America, King Blue River came up and kicked the shit out of everybody?
Yeah, I want something like that to happen as well. I mean, if we ever get a King of Fighters on the main stage again one day, South America and Mexico have really strong SNK players.
Yeah. I think the more global the fighting game community is, the more equal access we grant to everyone, the better off everyone is. It's like free trade. We get more styles, we get an incredible range of new players, and we just get more passionate, more ideas.
I mean, it happens the most in Street Fighter. Wasn't it a few years ago that you had the French player who played on a PlayStation 1 pad? Not even a DualShock, a non-analog PlayStation 1 pad, and won. Yep. Yeah, and...
Yeah, we sure did.
And I really want to see more of that stuff. I guess the contemporary equivalent of that is that Dragon Ball is bringing together people from different game backgrounds, but not as many from different, cultural backgrounds, at least on the main Evo stage.
Well, and that partially is because it's Dragon Ball's first Evo, right? I think there was, I'm sure for especially for international audiences, there was a question of and do I want to buy in for this unproven game at Evo? I hope next year we're going to get people, because Dragon Ball has pretty universal appeal, I think.
Yes.
I think we're going to get people from around the world, and I'm really excited.
Yes, and I would be extremely surprised if after this showing we don't get Dragon Ball next year again. It would be ridiculous if we didn't.
I mean, I half expect, I don't think this is actually going to happen, but, like, I would not be that surprised if they were like, and Dragon Ball's the final game.
It's very weird because you have to compare the brand recognition of Dragon Ball and Street Fighter and, like, which one of the two has the bigger brand appeal, and then which one of the two has the bigger brand appeal on a stage like Evo. So, like, moving Street Fighter from the final game, like the big finale, is something that's really difficult.
It's a very big decision.
Yes. Yes.
So I don't expect it to happen, but if it did, I would not be astonished, because I feel like Dragon Ball really... I mean, Dragon Ball was what everyone was talking about this year, throughout the whole tournament and after.
Yeah. Kind of I don't think it'll happen, mostly because... Street Fighter is not going the route that Marvel did, like becoming, you know, neglected and kind of toned down. They are, like, regardless of how the game, like, does and, like, what popular opinion is, that game is being actively worked on and expanded, like, all year. So, it has enough backing to be the big game, always. At least next year. When we come back and do Evo episode next year again, maybe the situation will be different.
Maybe. But we have been pretty general talking about the experience of fighting games, you know, as a spectator. We haven't touched on really that many Evo moments. And I think there are two we should touch on, two big moments that people are talking about from Evo this year that we would be remiss not to discuss.
I'll let you pick which tone you want to end the podcast with.
I mean, honestly, I think we should get the Dragon Ball one out of the way first, because I'm going to have more to say. I'm okay with ending the podcast by yelling at people.
please don't yell at me. Okay, so the Dragon Ball Z Grand Finals had a bit of a curveball, where during the grand finals, or rather between matches, in the grand finals to be more specific, Sonic Fox, playing versus Goichi, he requested a ruling that allowed him, as the player who had just lost, to switch sides. Like, to pick the player one side. And what this led to was, first off, confusion from the Evo staff, who weren't sure whether he was allowed to do that, at least going by the stream video. And then afterwards, once they have determined that yes, indeed he could do that, the confusion on with Goichi and them translating to him how to do it, and then having a coin flip to decide. So the coin flip was weird because they agreed on, they do a coin flip, and if Sonic Fox wins, he gets the player one seat. Technically, by the ruling, he was allowed to just get the player one side. That's it. Because he lost. And the issue with that was Goichi was pretty much in the zone. So the match before that ruling was invoked, he very convincingly beat Sonic Fox. And a lot of people... So I think the term is that Sonic Fox iced Goichi, a.k.a. Made it so he could cool off and get out of the lose momentum, essentially. And a lot of people attributed Sonic Fox victory to pulling off that, oh, I want to switch sides, having Goichi cool off, and that's why he won. And that's problematic on several levels, so I'll let you maybe start with the first one.
So I guess I'll start off by saying, I think being allowed to switch sides, like, so when two players match up in a tournament, which side they're on has been basically randomized before the match starts. And so the fact that, I mean, the second game of a set is technically a new game, it makes sense that you should be allowed to re-randomize. I think that's totally fair. I think that they, like, the rule that Goichi could just be player one is wrong. I think they were right to do a coin flip. Not like wrong as in that's not the rule. Wrong as in that's a stupid rule. But like, yeah, no, it's a new match. I think re-randomizing is totally fair. As far as, like, putting Goichi on ice, a few things. One, I mean, that rule is the rule. He's well within his rights to invoke it. Like, that was a rule that existed in the Evo books that just hadn't been invoked in such a long time that they forgot about it. And Sonic Fox remembered. So, he invoked a rule that existed. He's allowed to do that. It wasn't his fault it took so long. And two is, it's not like that's the only way to do that. People all the time lose a match and go to character select and just sit on character select for a minute to think or check their phones or do whatever. Like, this, like, momentum shifting is just part of the game. And if you don't want it to be, I think you could institute some rules being like, you have this much time, and maybe those rules do exist and they just don't come up. This much time between matches is what's permitted. You have to keep playing. But, like, this isn't a unique move on Goichi's part. I don't
Sonic Fox's part, let's say.
Sonic Fox's part. I don't have a problem with it.
Yeah. So, I have a few opinions on this, and I'm going to try to be, like, in the interest of time, very concise. Like, my first point is, I think when you see how they're playing, I think it is a ridiculous disservice to both players' skills that saying who was on which side determined the winner. Maybe, like, Sonic Fox, like, plays better on player one side. Like, let's say that hypothetically he said he switched sides just because he prefers playing on side one and he plays better. And I've only heard of that being, like, true in Tekken because the way Tekken is structured. But anyway,
it's a psychological thing.
Yeah.
It's a psychological thing.
Yeah. But even if he does play better there, because if you want a perfect comparison of two player skills in a game, reaching ideal conditions of those skills is pretty much impossible. Like, let's say if you want to determine who is quote-unquote objectively the better player, you would have to have something like 100 matches played, and both players need to have been playing in their ideal conditions, so well-rested, not jet-lag, in a familiar environment, without, you know, anxiety or crowd pressure. And then if somebody plays better under pressure, then you need to make sure that they have their ideal conditions so that they're put under pressure. So you will never actually get into a situation where you can determine objectively who is better and who is not. And that's why tournaments are structured with a common agreed upon rule set. And this is part of that commonly agreed upon rule set. Like, you can't really cherry pick, oh, well, this rule is, like, dumb, he can't use that, and this rule is okay, he can use that. Because it's a tournament, you have to agree on something, otherwise you will never actually determine a winner. Like, it's not feasible.
If we could do perfect theoretical vacuum conditions, then Flo would win every time. He does not.
Yes, yes. So it's like fighting games is not just raw skill. If winning was just raw skill, that would be, like, you know, that would be great. Like, I would love that. But it's also a lot of, like, having nerves, being able to handle the pressure. Like, if you look at the Guilty Gear matches, like, in the top 8, and you saw how well Lost Soul was playing, and then when the camera panned to his hands, he was shaking, he was shivering. Like, you were wondering how he was even holding those controls. And there's a lot of pressure there, and part of winning a tournament is also being able to handle that pressure, being able to handle curveballs and all sorts of things. So I think, like, this victory was all legit, and I think the reason why we wanted to cover this, we talked before we started recording, we talked a bit about whether we should cover this or not. The reason why we want to cover this is, as someone who is getting into fighting games, this is a very easy way to deceive yourself in what is a proper and improper way to play, and you will very quickly find yourself outvoiced in that regard, and I think that you will also hinder yourself to advance as a player, because, again, being a good player isn't just skill, it's about having nerves, it's about being able to handle change rapidly, it's about being able to play within imposed conditions and imposed formats.
move on to the bummer.
Yes.
So Smash 4 Grand Finals ended up being a Bayonetta player versus a Bayonetta player. And because of this, because the Smash 4 community has a big beef with Bayonetta and how they consider her to be, like, broken, overpowered, and feel that she should be banned from tournaments. A lot of them, not a universal, obviously. They, started, like, booing, and, like, some people walked out, and were basically protesting the fact that the final was happening. And in response, the players protested their protest and started screwing around in the middle of the match, until such a point that a tournament organizer had to walk up and say, like, fucking knock it off and play.
Yeah, you're actually not, by the rules, allowed to stall. Yes. Oof. Do you want to get something off your chest first, then?
So, everyone here is a piece of garbage. I mean, not the tournament organizer. You're good. But, like, okay, so first off, whether or not you think something should be banned, it wasn't. Shut the fuck up, sit down, and watch the game. Like, I'm sorry, this is your grand finals, those are your winners, you have to, like, you don't have to watch, if you want to leave, that's fine, but, like, if you want to boo them for playing the game, get out. This is, like, this is money for them. This is possibly their rent. Of course they're going to play the best character they can. Don't be ridiculous. And number two is, for the players, like, you're professionals. This is amateur hour. Like, the crowd boos you so you decide to fuck around? Like, that's pathetic. I would consider suspending them from pro play for a while as punishment for this incredibly unprofessional behavior. Everyone looks like a jackass.
Yeah. So I agree with you. Maybe not as articulate, so to say. But no, I think, like, for going back to what we mentioned, the game is not just represented by the developer and the commentators, it's represented by the players and by the community watching. And I think the people watching Smash, even let's say, I'm not going to claim I know whether this is the case or not, but let's say hypothetically, Bayonetta is objectively broken, and her existence in the game is objectively damaging towards the game. Problem is, I personally believe that that kind of protest and that kind of display of behavior is more damaging to that game and the perception of other people towards that community than having a mirror match final with the top tier character is. Like, people, yeah, like your reaction to having, like, two Bayonettas will be like, oh, okay, two Bayonettas, I guess this is the strongest character in the game or something, or a most popular one. The reaction to, like, having people boo the grand finals of the game they came to support, that reaction is going to be more like, wow, what a bunch of, you know, assholes. As for the actual players, I can understand where they're coming from in a way. Like, you've like went through hell to get to the grand finals, and then all the other players are booing you. Like, that's not what you did for. And I can understand the desire to spite, but also, again, you're representing your game on the main stage at Evo. You have to not give in to those kind of urges. Like, that's not behavior you should show off, and I think it's very understated. I guess it's because these incidents on the main stage in the grand finals don't happen that often, because people don't generally cause a scene. But there is this kind of expectation, and like actual like deserved expectation, that you should behave on the main stage and not do shifty shit like that. Like, my takeaway from this is, oh, I will probably play Smash with my friends, and I will, like, the opinion I had of the Smash community, whatever it may have been, is now much lower because of this.
Yeah. And I do want to be, like, we don't think we need to have a whole conversation about it, but for whoever's listening, if you're a Smash fan, I'm one of the people who thinks Bayonetta should be banned. I actually agree on that point. That doesn't excuse any of this.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's why I said, like if she is truly broken, if we're talking, like, Akuma Street Fighter levels of broken, like, yeah, sure, like she should probably be banned, but this is not the venue to do it, because I think what a lot of Smash players are used to is, at least this is my perception, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's a lot of, like, smaller local tournaments that have their own rule sets, and because Evo is kind of this massive common ground, what would probably be the better solution is, hey, after this Evo ends, hey, can we talk to the Evo organizers, and can we discuss how to handle these kind of situations in the future, because nobody likes to see, you know, a mirror match like this and a dominant character pick like this. And that's kind of an argument that people will listen to. Like, I think if somebody said, like, yeah, this is, like, damaging the game, they will go, okay, yeah, let's not use it. But if you're booing and, like, being immature like that, you might still get what you want, but you might also be ignored and not taken seriously.
Yeah, I mean, like, games have lost their Evo spots for less.
Oh, yeah. I still remember the BlazBlue Chrono Phantasma Grand Finals, which were amazing, and people who have never touched, they were ridiculous, and then next year, BlazBlue wasn't in the main stage, that's it, it's just gone.
Such a bummer.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it is because Smash is in a very privileged position, because it gets a lot of attendees, and it gets two games on the main stage. Like, I don't think any other series gets two of its games on stage. So it's in a very privileged position, but it's also, I wouldn't say, like, young, because they've been here for a while, but in general, it's very immature, or rather, it's very segregated from the rest of the fighting game community. Not entirely due to their own fault, because the fighting game community has the running joke of shunning Smash, but it's still a thing. Like how we say that, like, commentators try to pick up things from different fighting games, like how there's always kind of communication between Street Fighter, Dragon Ball, Arc System games. Like, there's usually some overlap, but there's almost never overlap with Smash and other fighting games. So, yeah.
And, like, you mentioned, like...
No, go ahead.
You mentioned, like, they're not young, but they kind of are. Like, the thing is, like, they're not young. The scene has been around for a while, but that's just that much time of them not having, like, a professional, like, main stage spotlight and being able to build some fairly amateur habits that are now hard for them to unlearn now that they're getting a big spotlight.
Yeah, yeah. It's not like... Like, I want this piece, like, dunking on Smash or dunking on the Smash community. I just think, like, every community, especially that's on stage and that's in Evo, it's responsible to how to represent their game and their community. And everybody needs to understand that these are, like, very hard stakes, high stakes. And it's very easy to just vanish. Like, you know, everybody thought that Marvel 3 would be forever, and then it stopped being forever. It's just stopped happening. Like, don't think that... Like you said, games have vanished for less. And I think also you don't want this perception. It's kind of a two-way street because, like I said, the FGC shuns Smash players, and then Smash players, you know, don't really care about, like, a lot of the other FGC games. It's a two-way street, but also somebody has to, like, start giving. And I don't know. I think it's, like, very irresponsible to represent something you're so passionate about and that you like so much in such a light.
Yeah. I think that's the last word on the
matter. Yes.
With that said, Neodrag, where can people find you on the internet?
On the internet, you can find me on twitter.com/mdkii, that's MDK Roman numerals 2. You can tweet at me and ask me things about this podcast, fighting games, video games, game dev, anything you really want. I will try my best to respond. And you can also catch my streams on twitch.tv/realsovietbear, where I play through entire games and also take breaks by playing fighting games and rhythm games. And where can people find you?
So I'm Six Detmar. You can find me on Twitter at Six Detmar. That's SixDetmar. If you want to find things that I do, I'll put a little bumper at the end because I have 7 podcasts. I should probably dial it back, but I will not. I've got a Patreon at patreon.com/scanlinemedia between me and my friend Jennifer, where we do, you know, that supports our podcasts like this one, and then also, you know, our writing, various other things. I like criticism and doing creative stuff. And occasionally you can find me on Mia Drag's podcast, usually losing their fight.
You mean streams, not podcasts. We're not fighting on the podcast.
Yes.
I hope.
Yes. Well, I mean, we do a little fighting on podcasts.
Sometimes, but yeah. Well, thank you all for listening in, and have a nice month. We will catch you in 30 or 31 days, I forget.